Part 2. Cease not till death. If I were a writer of books, I would compile a register with a comment of the various deaths of men. He who should teach men to die would at the same time teach them to live. Michel de Montaigne. That to study philosophy is to learn to die. Lying next to Lucy in the hospital bed, both of us crying, the CT scans images still glowing on the computer screen, that identity as a physician, my identity, no longer mattered. With the cancer having invaded multiple organ systems, the diagnosis was clear. The room was quiet. Lucy told me she loved me. I don't want to die, I said. I told her to remarry, that I couldn't bear the thought of her being alone. I told her we should refinance the mortgage immediately. We started calling family members. At some point, Victoria came by the room, and we discussed the scan and the likely future treatments. When she brought up the logistics of returning to residency, I stopped her. Victoria, I said, I'm never coming back to this hospital as a doctor, don't you think? One chapter of my life seemed to have ended. Perhaps the whole book was closing. Instead of being the pastoral figure adding a life transition, I found myself the sheep lost and confused. Severe illness wasn't life-altering. It was life-shattering. It felt less like an epiphany, a piercing burst of light, illuminating what really matters, and more like someone had just firebombed the path forward. Now I would have to work around it. My brother Jivan had arrived at my bedside. You've accomplished so much, he said. You know that, don't you? I sighed. He meant well, but the words rang hollow. My life had been building potential that would now go unrealized. I had planned to do so much, and I had come so close. I was physically debilitated. My imagined future and any present identity collapsed, and I faced the same existential quandaries my patients faced. The lung cancer diagnosis was confirmed. My carefully planned and hard-won future no longer existed. Death, so familiar to me in my work, was now paying a personal visit. Here we were, finally face to face, and yet nothing about it seemed recognizable. Standing at the crossroads where I should have been able to see and follow the footprints of the countless patients I had treated over the years, I saw instead only a blank, a harsh, vacant, gleaming white desert, as if a sandstorm had erased all trace of familiarity. The sun was setting. I would be discharged the next morning. An oncology appointment was set for later in the week, but the nurse told me my oncologist was going to drop by that night before leaving to pick up her kids. Her name was Emma Hayward, and she wanted to say hello before the initial office visit. I knew Emma a little. I had treated some of her patients before, but we had never spoken beyond passing professional courtesies. My parents and brothers were scattered about the room, not saying much, while Lucy sat by the bed holding my hand. The door opened, and in she walked, her white coat showing the wear of a long day, but her smile fresh. Trailing behind her were her fellow and a resident. Emma was only a few years older than I, her hair long and dark, but as is common to all those who spend time with death, streaked with gray. She pulled up a chair. Hi, my name is Emma, she said. I'm sorry to have to be so brief today, but I wanted to come by and introduce myself. We shook hands, my arm entangled in the IV line. Thanks for stopping by, I said. I know you have kids to pick up. This is my family. She nodded hello at Lucy, at my brothers and parents. I'm sorry this is happening to you, she said, to all of you. There will be a lot of time to talk in a couple days. I went ahead and had the lab start running some tests on your tumor sample, which will help guide therapy. Treatment may be chemotherapy or not, depending on the tests. 18 months earlier, I'd been in the hospital with appendicitis. Then I'd been treated not as a patient but as a colleague, almost like a consultant on my own case. I expected the same here. I know now's not the time, I proceeded, but I will want to talk about the Kaplan-Meier survival curves. No, she said, absolutely not. A brief silence. How dare she, I thought. This is how doctors like me, understand prognostication. I have a right to know. We can talk about the therapies later, she said. We can talk about your going back to work, too, if that's what you'd like to do. The traditional chemotherapy combination, cisplatin, pemetrexed, possibly with Avastin, too, has a high rate of peripheral neuropathy, so we'd probably switch the cisplatin for carboplatin, which will protect your nerves better, since you are a surgeon. Go back to work? What is she talking about? Is she delusional? Or am I dead wrong about my prognosis? And how can we talk about any of this without a realistic estimate of survival? The ground, having already buckled and roiled over the past few days, did so again. We can do details later, she continued, as I know this is a lot to absorb. Mostly, I just wanted to meet you all before our appointment Thursday. Is there anything I can do or answer besides survival curves today? No, I said, my mind reeling. Thanks so much for stopping by. I really appreciate it. Here is my card, she said. And there's the clinic number. Feel free to call if anything comes up before we see you in 2 days. My family and friends quickly wired through our network of medical colleagues to find out who the best lung cancer oncologists in the country were. Houston and New York had major cancer centers. Was that where I should be treated? The logistics of moving or temporarily relocating or what have you, that could be sorted out later. The replies came back quickly, and more or less unanimously. Emma not only was one of the best, a world-renowned oncologist who served as the lung cancer expert on one of the major national cancer advisory boards, but she was also known to be compassionate, someone who knew when to push and when to hold back. I briefly wondered, at the string of events that had sent me looping through the world, my residency determined by a computerized match process, only to end up assigned here, with a freak diagnosis, in the hands of one of the finest doctors to treat it. Having spent the better part of the week bedridden, with the cancer progressing, I had grown noticeably weaker. My body and the identity tied to it had radically changed. No longer was getting in and out of bed to go to the bathroom an automated subcortical motor program. It took effort and planning. The physical therapist left a list of items to ease my transition home. A cane, a modified toilet seat, foam blocks for leg support while resting, a bevy of new pain medications was prescribed. As I hobbled out of the hospital, I wondered how, just 6 days ago, I had spent nearly 36 straight hours in the operating room. Had I grown that much sicker in a week? Yes, in part. But I had also used a number of tricks and help from co-surgeons to get through those 36 hours. And even so, I had suffered excruciating pain. Had the confirmation of my fears in the CT scan, in the lab results, both showing not merely cancer but a body overwhelmed, nearing death, released me from the duty to serve, from my duty to patients, to neurosurgery, to the pursuit of goodness? Yes, I thought, and therein was the paradox. Like a runner crossing the finish line only to collapse, without that duty to care for the ill pushing me forward, I became an invalid. Usually, when I had a patient with a strange condition, I consulted the relevant specialist and spent time reading about it. This seemed no different, but as I started reading about chemo, which included a whole variety of agents and a raft of more modern novel treatments that targeted specific mutations, the sheer number of questions I had prevented any useful directed study. Alexander Pope, a little learning is a dangerous thing. Drink deep or taste not the Pierian spring. Without appropriate medical experience, I couldn't place myself in this new world of information, couldn't find my spot on the Kaplan-Meier curve. I waited, expectantly, for my clinic visit. But mostly, I rested. I sat, staring at a photo of Lucy and me from medical school, dancing and laughing. It was so sad, those two planning a life together, unaware, never suspecting their own fragility. My friend Lori had had a fiancé when she died in a car accident. Was this any crueler? My family engaged in a flurry of activity to transform my life from that of a doctor to that of a patient. We set up an account with a mail-order pharmacy, ordered a bed rail, and bought an ergonomic mattress to help alleviate the searing back pain. Our financial plan, which a few days before had banked on my income increasing sixfold in the next year, now looked precarious, and a variety of new financial instruments seemed necessary to protect Lucy. My father declared that these modifications were capitulations to the disease. I was going to beat this thing. I would somehow be cured. How often had I heard a patient's family member make similar declarations? I never knew what to say to them then, and I didn't know what to say to my father now. What was the alternate story? 2 days later, Lucy and I met Emma in the clinic. My parents hovered in the waiting room. The medical assistant took my vitals. Emma and her nurse practitioner were remarkably punctual, and Emma pulled up a chair in front of me to talk face to face, eye to eye. "Hello again," she said. "This is Alexis, my right hand." She gestured to the NP, who sat at the computer taking notes. "I know there's a lot to discuss, but first, how are you doing?" "Okay, all things considered," I said, enjoying my vacation, I guess. "How are you?" She paused. Patients don't typically ask how their doctors are doing, but Emma was also a colleague. "I'm running the inpatient service this week, so you know how that is." She smiled. Lucy and I did know. Outpatient specialists rotated on the inpatient service periodically, adding several hours of work in an already jam-packed day. After more pleasantries, we settled into a comfortable discussion on the state of lung cancer research. "There were two paths forward," she said. "The traditional method was chemotherapy, which generically targeted rapidly dividing cells, primary cancer cells, but also cells in your bone marrow, hair follicles, intestines, and so forth." Emma reviewed the data and options, lecturing as if to another doctor, but again, with the exception of any mention of Kaplan-Meier survival codes. Newer therapies had been developed, however, targeting specific molecular defects in the cancer itself. I had heard rumors of such efforts. It had been a holy grail in cancer work, and was surprised to learn how much progress had been made. These treatments, it seemed, had led to long-term survival in some patients. "Most of your tests are back," Emma said. "You have a P1SK mutation, but no one's sure what that means yet. The test for the most common mutation in patients like you, EGFR, is still pending. I'm betting that's what you have, and if so, there's a pill called Tarceva that you can take instead of chemotherapy. That result should be back tomorrow, Friday, but you're sick enough that I've set you up for chemo starting Monday in case the EGFR test is negative." I immediately felt a kinship. This was exactly how I approached neurosurgery. Have a plan, A, B, and C, at all times. With chemo, our main decision will be carboplatin versus cisplatin. In isolated studies, head-to-head carboplatin is better tolerated. Cisplatin has potentially better results, but much worse toxicity, especially for the nerves, though all the data is old, and there's no direct comparison with our modern chemo regimens. Do you have any thoughts? I'm less worried about protecting my hands for surgery, I said. There's a lot I can do with my life. If I lose my hands, I can find another job, or not work, or something. She paused. Let me ask you this. Is surgery important to you? Is it something you want to do? Well, yes, I've spent almost a third of my life preparing for it. Okay, then. I'm going to suggest we stick with the carboplatin. I don't think it will change survival, and I do think it could dramatically change your quality of life. Do you have any other questions? She seemed clear that this was the way to go, and I was happy to follow. Maybe I began to let myself believe performing surgery again was a possibility. I felt myself relax a little. Can I start smoking? I joked. Lucy laughed, and Emma rolled her eyes. No. Any serious questions? The Kaplan Meier will not discuss that, she said. I didn't understand her resistance. After all, I was a doctor familiar with these statistics. I could look them up myself, so that's what I would have to do. Okay, I said. I think everything is pretty clear. We'll hear from you tomorrow about the EGFR results. If yes, then we'll start a pill, Tarceva. If no, we start chemotherapy Monday. Right. The other thing I want you to know is this. I am your doctor now. Any problem you have, from primary care to whatever, you come to us first. Again, I felt a pang of kinship. Thanks, I said, and good luck on the inpatient wards. She left the room, only to pop her head back in seconds later. Feel free to say no to this, but there are some lung cancer fundraisers who would love to meet you. Don't answer now. Think about it. And let Alexis know if you might be interested. Don't do anything you don't want to. As we left, Lucy remarked, "She's great. She's a good fit for you. Although," she smiled, "I think she likes you." And, well, there's a study that says doctors do a worse job prognosticating for patients they're personally invested in. On our list of things to worry about, I said, with a laugh, I think that's in the bottom quartile. I began to realize that coming in such close contact with my own mortality had changed both nothing and everything. Before my cancer was diagnosed, I knew that someday I would die, but I didn't know when. After the diagnosis, I knew that someday I would die, but I didn't know when. But now I knew it acutely. The problem wasn't really a scientific one. The fact of death is unsettling, yet there is no other way to live. Slowly, the medical fog was clearing. At least now I had enough information to dive into the literature. While the numbers were fuzzy, having an EGFR mutation seemed to add around a year of life on average, with the potential for long-term survival. Not having it suggested an 80% chance of death within 2 years. Clarifying the rest of my life was going to be a process. The next day, Lucy and I went to the sperm bank to preserve gametes and options. We had always planned to have kids at the end of my residency, but now the cancer drugs would have an unknown effect on my sperm, so to keep a chance of having children, we'd have to freeze sperm before I started treatment. A young woman walked us through a variety of payment plans and options for storage and legal forms for ownership. On her desk were a multitude of colorful pamphlets about various social outings for young people with cancer, improv groups, a cappella groups, open mic nights, and so on. I envied their happy faces, knowing that, statistically, they all probably had highly treatable forms of cancer and reasonable life expectancies. Only 0.0012% of 36-year-olds get lung cancer. Yes, all cancer patients are unlucky, but there's cancer, and then there's cancer, and you have to be really unlucky to have the latter. When she'd asked us to specify what would happen to the sperm if one of us were to die, who would legally own them in the event of death? Tears began rolling down Lucy's face. The word hope first appeared in English about 1,000 years ago, denoting some combination of confidence and desire. But what I desired, life, was not what I was confident about, death. When I talked about hope, then did I really mean leave some room for unfounded desire? No. Medical statistics not only describe numbers such as mean survival, they measure our confidence in our numbers with tools like confidence levels, confidence intervals, and confidence bounds. So did I mean leave some room for a statistically improbable but still plausible outcome? A survival just above the measured 95% confidence levels? Is that what hope was? Could we divide the curve into existential sections from defeated to pessimistic to realistic to hopeful to delusional? Weren't the numbers just the numbers? Had we all just given in to the hope that every patient was above average? It occurred to me that my relationship with statistics changed as soon as I became one. During my residency, I had sat with countless patients and families to discuss grim prognoses. It's one of the most important jobs you have as a physician. It's easier when the patient is 94 in the last stages of dementia with a severe brain bleed. But for someone like me, a 36-year-old, given a diagnosis of terminal cancer, there aren't really words. The reason doctors don't give patients specific prognoses is not merely because they cannot. Certainly, if a patient's expectations are way out of bounds of probability, someone expecting to live to 130, say, or someone thinking his benign skin spots are signs of imminent death, doctors are entrusted to bring that person's expectations into the realm of reasonable possibility. What patients seek is not scientific knowledge that doctors hide, but existential authenticity each person must find on her own. Getting too deeply into statistics is like trying to quench a thirst with salty water. The angst of facing mortality has no remedy in probability. When we arrived home from the sperm bank, I got a phone call saying that I did, in fact, have a treatable mutation, EGFR. Chemo was off, thankfully, and Tarceva, a little white pill, became my treatment. I soon began to feel stronger, and even though I no longer really knew what it was, I felt it, a drop of hope. The fog surrounding my life rolled back another inch, and a sliver of blue sky peeked through. In the weeks that followed, my appetite returned, I put on a little weight, I developed the characteristic severe acne that correlates with a good response. Lucy had always loved my smooth skin, but now it was pockmarked and with my blood thinners constantly bleeding. Any part of me that identified with being handsome was slowly being erased, though in fairness, I was happy to be uglier and alive. Lucy said she loved my skin just the same, acne and all, but while I knew that our identities derived not just from the brain, I was living its embodied nature. The man who loved hunting, camping, and running, who expressed his love through gigantic hugs, who threw his giggling niece high in the air, that was a man I no longer was. At best, I could aim to be him again. At our first several biweekly appointments, Emma and my discussion tended from the medical, how's the rash, to the more existential. The traditional cancer narrative, that one ought to recede, spend time with family, and settle one's toes in the peat, was one option. Many people, once diagnosed, quit work entirely, she said. Others focus on it heavily. Either way, it's okay. I had mapped out this whole 40-year career for myself, the first 20 as a surgeon scientist, the last 20 as a writer. But now that I am likely well into my last 20 years, I don't know which career I should be pursuing. Well, I can't tell you that, she said. I can only say that you can get back to surgery if you want, but you have to figure out what's most important to you. If I had some sense of how much time I have left, it'd be easier. If I had 2 years, I'd write. If I had 10, I'd get back to surgery and science. You know I can't give you a number. Yes, I knew. It was up to me, to quote her oft-repeated refrain, to find my values. Part of me felt this was a cop-out. Okay, fine. I never gave out specific numbers to patients, either. But didn't I always have a sense of how the patient would do? How else did I make life and death decisions? Then I recalled the times I had been wrong, the time I had consulted a family to withdraw life support for their son, only for the parents to appear 2 years later showing me a YouTube video of him playing piano and delivering cupcakes in thanks for saving his life. My oncology appointments were the most important of many new appointments with a variety of healthcare providers, but they weren't the only ones. At Lucy's insistence, we began seeing a couple's therapist who specialized in cancer patients. Sitting in her windowless office, in side-by-side armchairs, Lucy and I detailed the ways in which our lives, present and future, had been fractured by my diagnosis, and the pain of knowing and not knowing the future, the difficulty in planning, the necessity of being there for each other. In truth, cancer had helped save our marriage. Well, you two are coping with this better than any couple I've seen, the therapist said at the end of our first session. I'm not sure I have any advice for you. I laughed as we walked out. At least I was excelling at something again. The years of ministering to terminally ill patients had borne some fruit. I turned to Lucy, expecting to see a smile. Instead, she was shaking her head. Don't you get it? She said, taking my hand in hers. If we're the best at this, that means it doesn't get better than this. If the weight of mortality does not grow lighter, does it at least get more familiar? Once I had been diagnosed with a terminal illness, I began to view the world through two perspectives. I was starting to see death as both doctor and patient. As a doctor, I knew not to declare, cancer is a battle, I'm going to win, or ask, why me? Answer, why not me? I knew a lot about medical care, complications, and treatment algorithms. I quickly learned from my oncologist and my own study that stage 4 lung cancer today was a disease whose story might be changing. Like AIDS in the late 1980s, still a rapidly fatal illness, but with emerging therapies that were, for the first time, providing years of life. While being trained as a physician and scientist had helped me process the data and accept the limits of what that data could reveal about my prognosis, it didn't help me as a patient. It didn't tell Lucy and me whether we should go ahead and have a child or what it meant to nurture a new life while mine faded. Nor did it tell me whether to fight my cancer, to reclaim the ambitions I had single-mindedly pursued for so long, but without the surety of the time to complete them. Like my own patients, I had to face my mortality and try to understand what made my life worth living, and I needed Emma's help to do so. Torn between a doctor and being a patient, delving into medical science and turning back to literature for answers, I struggled while facing my own death to rebuild my old life, or perhaps find a new one. The bulk of my week was spent not in cognitive therapy, but in physical therapy. I had sent nearly every one of my patients to physical therapy, and now I found myself shocked at how difficult it was. As a doctor, you have a sense of what it's like to be sick, but until you've gone through it yourself, you don't really know. It's like falling in love or having a kid. You don't appreciate the mounds of paperwork that come along with it, or the little things. When you get an IV placed, for example, you can actually taste the salt when they start infusing it. They tell me that this happens to everybody, but even after 11 years in medicine, I had never known. In physical therapy, I was not even lifting weights yet, just lifting my legs. This was exhausting and humiliating. My brain was fine, but I did not feel like myself. My body was frail and weak. The person who could run half marathons was a distant memory. And that, too, shapes your identity. Racking back pain can mold an identity. Fatigue and nausea can as well. Karen, my PT, asked me what my goals were. I picked two: riding my bike and going for a run. In the face of weaknesses, determination set in. Day after day I kept at it, and every tiny increase in strength broadened the possible worlds, the possible versions of me. I started adding reps, weights, and minutes to my workouts, pushing myself to the point of vomiting. After 2 months, I could sit for 30 minutes without tiring. I could start going to dinner with friends again. One afternoon, Lucy and I drove down to Kanata Road, our favorite biking spot. Usually, we would bike there. Pride forces me to add, but the hills were still too formidable for my lightweight frame. I managed 6 wobbly miles. It was a far cry from the breezy 30-mile rides of the previous summer, but at least I could balance on 2 wheels. Was this a victory or a defeat? I began to look forward to my meetings with Emma. In her office, I felt like myself, like a self. Outside her office, I no longer knew who I was, because I wasn't working. I didn't feel like myself, a neurosurgeon, a scientist, a young man, relatively speaking, with a bright future spread before him. Debilitated at home, I feared I wasn't much of a husband for Lucy. I had passed from the subject to the direct object of every sentence in my life. In 14th century philosophy, the word patient simply meant the object of an action, and I felt like one. As a doctor, I was an agent, a cause. As a patient, I was merely something to which things happen. But in Emma's office, Lucy and I could joke, trade doctor lingo, talk freely about our hopes and dreams, try to assemble a plan to move forward. 2 months in, Emma remained vague about my prognostication, and every statistic I cited she rebuffed with a reminder to focus on my values. Though I felt dissatisfied, at least I felt like somebody, a person, rather than a thing, exemplifying the second law of thermodynamics. All order tends toward entropy, decay, and so forth. Flush in the face of mortality, many decisions became compressed, urgent, and unreceding. Foremost among them, for us, should Lucy and I have a child. Even if our marriage had been strained toward the end of my residency, we had always remained very much in love. Our relationship was still deep in meaning, a shared and evolving vocabulary about what mattered. If human rationality formed the bedrock of meaning, it seemed to us that rearing a child added another dimension to that meaning. It had been something we'd always wanted, and we were both impelled by the instinct to do it still, to add another chair to our family's table. Both of us, yearning to be parents, we each thought of the other. Lucy hoped I had years left, but understanding my prognosis, she felt that the choice, whether to spend my remaining time as a father, should be mine. "What are you most afraid or sad about?" she asked me one night as we were lying in bed. "Leaving you," I told her. I knew a child would bring joy to the whole family, and I couldn't bear to picture Lucy husbandless and childless after I died. But I was adamant that the decision ultimately be hers. She would likely have to raise the child on her own, after all, and to care for both of us as my illness progressed. "Will having a newborn distract you from the time we have together?" she asked. "Don't you think saying goodbye to your child will make your death more painful?" "Wouldn't it be great if it did?" I said. Lucy and I both felt that life wasn't about avoiding suffering. Years ago, it had occurred to me that Darwin and Nietzsche agreed on one thing. The defining characteristic of the organism is striving. Describing life otherwise was like painting a tiger without stripes. After so many years of living with death, I'd come to understand that the easiest death wasn't necessarily the best. We talked it over. Our families gave their blessing. We decided to have a child. We would carry on living instead of dying. Because of the medications I was on, assisted reproduction appeared to be the only route forward. So we visited a specialist at a reproductive endocrinology clinic in Palo Alto. She was efficient and professional, but her lack of experience dealing with terminally ill, as opposed to infertile, patients was obvious. She plowed through her spiel, eyes on her clipboard. "How long have you been trying?" "Well, we haven't yet." "Oh, right, of course." Finally, she asked, "Given your situation, I assume you want to get pregnant fast." "Yes," Lucy said. "We'd like to get started right away." "I'd suggest you begin with an IVF then," she said. When I mentioned that we'd rather minimize how many embryos were created and destroyed, she looked slightly confused. Most people who came here prized expedience above all. But I was determined to avoid the situation where, after I died, Lucy had responsibility for a half dozen embryos, the last remnants of our shared genomes, my last presence on this earth, stuck in a freezer somewhere, too painful to destroy, impossible to bring to full humanity, technological artifacts that no one knew how to relate to. But after several trials of intrauterine insemination, it was clear we needed a high level of technology. We would need to create at least a few embryos in vitro and implant the healthiest. The others would die. Even in having children in this new life, death played its part. 6 weeks after starting treatment, I was due for my first CT scan to measure the efficacy of the Tarceva. As I hopped out of the scanner, the CT tech looked at me. "Well, doc," he offered, "I'm not supposed to say this, but there's a computer back there if you want to take a look." I loaded up the images on the viewer, typing in my own name. The acne was a reassuring sign. My strength had also improved, though I was still limited by back pain and fatigue. Sitting there, I reminded myself of what Emma had said. Even a small amount of tumor growth, so long as it was small, would be considered a success. My father, of course, had predicted that all cancer would be gone. "Your scan will be clear, Pubby," he declared, using my family's nickname. I repeated to myself that even small growth was good news, took a breath, and clicked. The images materialized on the screen. My lungs, speckled with innumerable tumors before, were clear except for 1 centimeter nodule in the right upper lobe. I could make out my spine beginning to heal. There had been a clear, dramatic reduction in tumor burden. Relief washed over me. My cancer was stable. When we met with Emma the next day, she still refused to talk prognosis, but she said, "You're well enough that we can meet every 6 weeks now. Next time we meet, we can start to talk about what your life might be like." I could feel the chaos of the past months receding, a sense of a new order settling in. My contracted sense of the future began to relax. A local meeting of former Stanford neurosurgery graduates was happening that weekend, and I looked forward to the chance to reconnect with my former self. Yet being there merely heightened the surreal contrast of what my life was now. I was surrounded by success and possibility and ambition, by peers and seniors whose lives were running along a trajectory that was no longer mine, whose bodies could still tolerate standing for a grueling 8-hour surgery. I felt trapped inside a reverse Christmas card. Victoria was opening the happy present, grants, job offers, publications. I should be sharing. My senior peers were living the future that was no longer mine. Early career awards, promotions, new houses. No one asked about my plans, which was a relief, since I had none. While I could now walk without a cane, a paralytic uncertainty loomed. Who would I be going forward, and for how long? Invalid? Scientist? Teacher? Bioethicist? Neurosurgeon once again, as Emma had implied? Stay-at-home dad? Writer? Who could or should I be? As a doctor, I had had some sense of what patients with life-changing illnesses faced, and it was exactly these moments I had wanted to explore with them. Shouldn't terminal illness, then, be the perfect gift to that young man who had wanted to understand death? What better way to understand it than to live it? But I had no idea how hard it would be, how much terrain I would have to explain, map, settle. I'd always imagined the doctor's work as something like connecting two pieces of railroad track, allowing a smooth journey for the patient. I hadn't expected the prospect of facing my own mortality to be so disorienting, so dislocating. I thought back to my younger self, who might have wanted to, quote, forge in the smithy of my soul the uncreated consciousness of my race, unquote. Looking into my own soul, I found the tools too brittle, the fire too weak, to forge even my own consciousness. Lost in a featureless wasteland of my own mortality, and finding no traction in the reams of scientific studies, intracellular molecular pathways, and endless curves of survival statistics, I began reading literature again. Sojourneski's Cancer Ward, B.J. Johnson's The Unfortunates, Tolstoy's Ivan Illich, Nagel's Mind and Cosmos, Wolfe, Kafka, Montaigne, Frost, Grenville, memoirs of cancer patients, anything by anyone who had ever written about mortality. I was searching for a vocabulary with which to make sense of death, to find a way to begin defining myself and inching forward again. The privilege of direct experience had led me away from literary and academic work. Yet now I felt that to understand my own experiences, I would have to translate them back into language. Hemingway described his process in similar terms, acquiring rich experiences, then retreating to cogitate and write about them. I needed words to go forward. And so it was, literature that brought me back to life during this time. The monolithic uncertainty of my future was deadening. Everywhere I turned, the shadow of death obscured the meaning of any action. I remember the moment when my overwhelming unease yielded, when that seemingly impassable sea of uncertainty parted. I woke up in pain, facing another day. No project beyond breakfast seemed tenable. I can't go on, I thought, and immediately its antiphon responded, compelling Samuel Beckett's seven words, words I had learned long ago as an undergraduate. I'll go on. I got out of bed and took a step forward, repeating the phrase over and over. I can't go on. I'll go on. That morning, I made a decision. I would push myself to return to the OR. Why? Because I could. Because that's who I was. Because I would have to learn to live in a different way, seeing death as an imposing itinerant visitor, but knowing that even if I'm dying, until I actually die, I am still living. Over the next 6 weeks, I altered my physical therapy program, focusing now on building strength specifically for operating. Long hours of standing, micro-manipulation of small objects, pronation for placing pedicle screws. Another CT followed. The tumor had shrunk slightly more. Going over the images with me, Emma said, I don't know how long you've got, but I will say this. The patient I saw just before you today has been on Tarceva for 7 years without a problem. You've still got a ways to go before we're that comfortable with your cancer. But looking at you, thinking about living 10 years is not crazy. You might not make it, but it's not crazy. Here was the prognostication. No, not prognostication, justification. Justification of my decision to return to neurosurgery, to return to life. One part of me exulted at the prospect of 10 years. Another part wished, she'd said, going back to being a neurosurgeon is crazy for you. Pick something easier. I was startled to realize that in spite of everything, the last few months had had one area of lightness, not having to bear the tremendous weight of the responsibility neurosurgery demanded. And part of me wanted to be excused from picking up that yoke again. Neurosurgery is really hard work, and no one would have faulted me for not going back. People often ask if it is a calling, and my answer is always yes. You can't see it as a job, because if it's a job, it's one of the worst jobs there is. A couple of my professors actively discouraged the idea. Shouldn't you be spending time with your family? Shouldn't you? I wondered. I was making the decision to do this work because this work, to me, was a sacred thing. Lucy and I had just reached the top of the hill. The landmarks of Silicon Valley, buildings bearing the names of every biochemical and technological transformation of the last generation, unfolding before us. Eventually, though, the itch to hold a surgical drill again had become too compelling. Moral duty has weight. Things that have weight have gravity, and so the duty to bear moral responsibility pulled me back into the operating room. Lucy was fully supportive. I called up the program director to tell him I was ready to return. He was thrilled. Victoria and I talked about how best to reintroduce myself to get me back up to speed. I requested that a fellow resident be available to back me up at all times in case something went awry. Furthermore, I would do only one case per day. I wouldn't manage the patients outside the OR or be on call. We'd proceed conservatively. The OR schedule came out, and I was assigned a temporal lobectomy, one of my favorite operations. Commonly, epilepsy is caused by a misfiring hippocampus, which is located deep in the temporal lobe. Removing the hippocampus can cure the epilepsy, but the operation is complex, requiring gentle dissection of the hippocampus off the pia, the delicate transparent covering of the brain right near the brain stem. I spent the night prior poring through surgical textbooks, reviewing the anatomy and steps of the operation. I slept restlessly, seeing the angle of the head, the saw against the skull, the way the light reflects off the pia once the temporal lobe is removed. I got out of bed and put on a shirt and tie. I had returned all my scrubs months ago, assuming I would never need them again. I arrived at the hospital and changed into familiar blue garb for the first time in 18 weeks. I chatted with the patient to make sure there were no last-minute questions, then began the process of setting up the OR. The patient was intubated, the attending and I were scrubbed and ready to begin. I picked up the scalp and incised the skin just above the ear, proceeding slowly, trying to make sure I forgot nothing and make no mistakes. With the electrocautery, I deepened the incision to the bone, then elevated the skin flap with hooks. Everything felt familiar, muscle memory kicking in. I took the drill and made three holes in the skull. The attending squirted water to keep the drill cool as I worked. Switching to the craniotome, a sideways cutting drill bit, I connected the holes, freeing up a large piece of bone. With a crack, I pried it off. There lie the silvery dura. Happily, I hadn't damaged it with the drill, a common beginner's mistake. I used a sharp knife to open the dura without injuring the brain. Success again. I began to relax. I tacked back the dura with small stitches to keep it out of the way of the main surgery. The brain gently pulsed and glistened. The huge Sylvian veins ran across the top of the temporal lobe pristine. The familiar peach convolutions of the brain beckoned. Suddenly, the edges of my vision dimmed. I put down my instruments and stepped back from the table. The blackness encroached farther as a feeling of lightness overcame me. "Sorry, sir," I told the attendant. "I'm feeling a little faint. I think I need to lie down. Jack, my junior resident, will finish the case." Jack arrived quickly, and I excused myself. I sipped some orange juice in the lounge, lying on the couch. After 20 minutes, I began to feel better. "Neurocardiogenic syncope," I whispered to myself. "The automatic nervous system briefly shutting down the heart. Or, as it's more commonly known, a case of nerves. A rookie problem." This was not how I'd envisioned my return to the OR. I went to the locker room, threw my dirty scrubs in the laundry, and put on my civilian clothes. On the way out, I grabbed a stack of clean scrubs. Tomorrow, I told myself, would be a better day. It was. Every day, each case felt familiar, but moved a little more slowly. On day three, I was removing a degenerated disc from a patient's spine. I stared at the bulging disc, not remembering my exact move. A fellow supervising me suggested taking small bites with a rongeur. "Yeah, I know that's how it's usually done," I mumbled, "but there's another way." I nibbled away for 20 minutes, my brain searching for the more elegant way I had learned to do this. At the next spinal level, it came back to me in a flash. "Cobb instrument," I called out. "Mallet. Kerosene." I had the whole disc removed in 30 seconds. "That's how I do this," I said. Over the next couple of weeks, my strength continued to improve, as did my fluency and technique. My hands relearned how to manipulate submillimeter blood vessels without injury, my fingers conjuring up the old tricks they'd once known. After a month, I was operating a nearly full load. I kept myself limited to operating, leaving the administration, patient care, and night and weekend calls to Victoria and other senior residents. I had already mastered those skills anyway, and needed to learn only the nuances of complex operations to feel complete. I ended my days exhausted beyond measure, muscles on fire, slowly improving. But the truth was, it was joyless. The visceral pleasure I'd found in operating was gone, replaced by an iron focus on overcoming the nausea, the pain, the fatigue. Coming home each night, I would scarf down a handful of pain pills, then crawl into bed next to Lucy, who had returned to a full work schedule as well. She was now in the first trimester of pregnancy, with the baby due in June, when I would complete residency. We had a photo of our child as a blastocyst taken but just before implantation. "She has your cell membrane," I remarked to Lucy. Still, I was determined to restore my life to its prior trajectory. Another stable scan 6 months after diagnosis passed, and I reopened my job search. With my cancer under control, I might have several years left. It seemed the career I had worked for years to attain, which had disappeared amid disease, was now back in reach. I could almost hear trumpets sounding a victory fanfare. During my next visit with Emma, we talked about life and where it was taking me. I recalled Henry Adams trying to compare the scientific force of the combustion engine and the existential force of the Virgin Mary. The scientific questions were settled for now, allowing the existential ones full play, yet both were in the doctor's purview. I had recently learned that the surgeon-scientist position at Stanford, the job for which I had been heir apparent, had been filled while I was out sick. I was crushed and told her so. "Well," she said, "that this doctor-professor thing can be a real grind. But you know that already. I'm sorry." "Yeah, I guess the science that excited me was about 20-year projects. Without that kind of time frame, I'm not sure I'm all that interested in being a scientist." I tried to console myself. "You can't get much done in a couple of years." "Right. And just remember, you're doing great. You're working again. You've got a baby on the way. You're finding your values, and that's not easy." Later that day, one of the younger professors, a former resident and close friend, stopped me in the hallway. "Hey," she said, "there's been a lot of discussion in the faculty meetings about what to do with you." "What to do with me? How?" "I think some professors are concerned about your graduating." Graduation from residency required two things: meeting a set of national and local requirements, which I'd already done, and the blessing of the faculty. "What?" I said. I don't mean to sound cocky, but I'm a good surgeon, just as I know. I think they probably just want to see you performing the full load of a chief. It's because they like you. Seriously." I realized it was true. For the past few months, I had been acting merely as a surgical technician. I had been using cancer as an excuse not to take full responsibility for my patients. On the other hand, it was a good excuse, damn it. But now I started coming in earlier, staying later, fully caring for the patients again, adding another 4 hours to a 12-hour day. It put the patients back in the center of my mind at all times. The first 2 days, I thought I would have to quit, battling waves of nausea, pain, and fatigue, retreating to an unused bed in down moments to sleep. But by the third day, I had begun to enjoy it again, despite the wreck of my body. Reconnecting with patients brought back the meaning of this work. I took antiemetics and non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, NSAIDs, between cases just before rounds. I was suffering, but I was fully back. Instead of finding an unused bed, I started resting on the junior's residence couch, supervising them on the care of my patients, lecturing as I rode a wave of back spasms. The more tortured my body became, the more I relished having done the work. At the end of the first week, I slept for 40 hours straight. But I was calling the shots. "Hey, boss," I said. "I was just reviewing cases for tomorrow, and I know the first case is booked interhemispheric, but I think it would be much safer and easier if we come parietal transcortical." "Really?" the attending said. "Let me look at the films." You know what? You're right. Can you change the booking? The next day, hi, sir, it's Paul. I just saw Mr. F and his family in the ICU. I think we'll need to take him tomorrow for an ACDF. Okay if I book it? When are you free? And I was back to full speed in the OR. Nurse, can you page Dr. S? I'm going to be done with this case before he gets here. I've got him on the phone. He says you can't possibly be done yet. The attending came running in, out of breath, scrubbed, and peered through the microscope. I took a slight acute angle to avoid the sinus, I said, but the whole tumor's out. You avoided the sinus? Yes, sir. You got it out in one piece? Yes, sir. It's on the table so you can have a look. Looks good. Really good. When did you get to be so fast? Sorry I wasn't here earlier. No trouble. The tricky part of illness is that as you go through it, your values are constantly changing. You try to figure out what matters to you, and then you keep figuring it out. I felt like someone had taken away my credit card, and I was having to learn how to budget. You may decide you want to spend your time working as a neurosurgeon, but 2 months later, you may feel differently. 2 months after that, you may want to learn to play the saxophone or devote yourself to the church. Death may be a one-time event, but living with terminal illness is a process. It struck me that I had traversed the five stages of grief: the denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance, cliché. But I had done it all backwards. On diagnosis, I'd been prepared for death. I'd even felt good about it. I'd accepted it. I'd been ready. Then I slumped into a depression, as it became clear that I might not be dying so soon after all, which is, of course, good news, but also confusing and strangely enervating. The rapidity of the cancer science and the nature of the statistics meant I might live another 12 months or 120. Grand illnesses are supposed to be life-clarifying. Instead, I knew I was going to die, but I'd known that before. My state of knowledge was the same, but my ability to make lunch plans had been shot to hell. The way forward would seem obvious if only I knew how many months or years I had left. Tell me 3 months, I'd spend time with my family. Tell me 1 year, I'd write a book. Give me 10 years, I'd get back to treating disease. The truth that you live one day at a time didn't help. What was I supposed to do with that day? At some point, then, I began to do a little bargaining. Or not exactly bargaining. More like, God, I have read Job, and I don't understand it. But if this is a test of faith, you now realize my faith is fairly weak, and probably leaving this spicy mustard off the pastrami sandwich would have also tested it. You didn't have to go nuclear on me, you know. Then after the bargaining came flashes of anger. I worked my whole life to get to this point, and then you give me cancer. And now, finally, maybe I had arrived at denial. Maybe total denial. Maybe, in the absence of any certainty, we should just assume that we're going to live a long time. Maybe that's the only way forward. I was operating until late at night or into the early morning, fixated on graduation, my diagnosis 9 months in the past. My body was taking a beating. I was too tired to eat when I got home. I had been slowly upping the dose of Tylenol and NSAIDs and antiemetics. I had developed a persistent cough, presumably caused by scarring from the dead tumor in my lungs. I only had to keep up this restless pace for a couple of more months, I told myself, and then I would graduate from residency and settle into the comparatively calmer role of a professor. In February, I flew to Wisconsin for a job interview. They were offering everything I wanted, millions of dollars to start a neuroscience lab, head of my own clinical service, flexibility if I needed it for my health, a tenured-track professorship, appealing job options for Lucy, high salary, beautiful scenery, idyllic town, the perfect boss. I understand about your health, and you probably have a strong connection with your oncologist, the department chairman told me. So if you want to keep your care there, we can fly you back and forth, though we do have a top-notch cancer center here, if you want to explore it. Is there anything else I can do to make this job more attractive? I thought about what Emma had told me. I had gone from being unable to believe I could be a surgeon to being one, a transformation that carried the force of religious conversion. She had always kept this part of my identity in mind, even when I couldn't. She had done what I had challenged myself to do as a doctor years earlier, accept mortal responsibility for my soul, and returned to me a point where I could return to myself. I had attained the heights of the neurosurgical trainee, set to become not only a neurosurgeon, but a surgeon scientist. Every trainee aspires to this goal. Almost none make it. That night, the chairman was driving me back to my hotel after dinner. He stopped the car and pulled over. "Let me show you something," he said. We got out and stood in front of the hospital, looking over a frozen lake, its far edges luminous with specks of light leaking from Faculty House. "In summer, you can swim or sail to work. In winter, you can ski or ice skate." It was like a fantasy, and in that moment, it hit me. It was a fantasy. We could never move to Wisconsin. What if I had a serious relapse in 2 years? Lucy would be isolated, stripped of her friends and family, alone, caring for a dying husband and a new child. As furiously as I had tried to resist it, I realized that cancer had changed the calculus. For the last several months, I had striven with every ounce to restore my life to its pre-cancer trajectory, trying to deny cancer any purchase on my life. As desperately as I now wanted to feel triumphant, instead I felt the claws of the crab holding me back. The curse of cancer created a strange and strained existence, challenging me to be neither blind to nor bound by death's approach. Even when the cancer was in retreat, it cast long shadows. When I'd first lost the professorship at Stanford, I'd consoled myself with the idea that running a lab made sense only on a 20-year timescale. Now I saw that this was, in fact, true. Freud started his career as a successful neurosurgeon. When he realized neuroscience would need at least a century to catch up with his true ambition of understanding the mind, he set aside his microscope. I think I felt something similar. Transforming neurosurgery through my research was a gamble whose odds had been made too long by my diagnoses. The lab wasn't the place I wanted to pluck the remainder of my chips. I could hear Emma's voice again. "You have to figure out what's most important to you." If I no longer sought to fly on the highest trajectory of neurosurgeon and neuroscience, what did I want? To be a father? To be a neurosurgeon? To teach? I didn't know. But if I did not know what I wanted, I had learned something, something not found in Hippocrates, Maimonides, or Osler. The physician's duty is not to stave off death or return patients to their old lives, but to take into our arms a patient and family whose lives have been disintegrated and work until they can stand back up and face and make sense of their own existence. My own hubris as a surgeon stood naked to me now, as much as I focused on my responsibility and power over patients' lives. It was, at best, a temporary responsibility, a fleeting power. Once an acute crisis had been resolved, the patient awakened, extubated, and then discharged, the patient and family go on living, and things are never quite the same. The physician's words can ease the mind, just as the neurosurgeon's scalpel can ease a disease of the brain. Yet their uncertainties and morbidities, whether emotional or physical, remain to be grappled with. Emma hadn't given me back my old identity. She protected my ability to forge a new one, and finally I knew I would have to. On a crystalline spring morning on the third Sunday of Lent, Lucy and I went to church with my parents, who had flown in from Arizona for a weekend visit. We sat together in a long wooden pew, and my mother struck up a conversation with the family sitting next to us, first complimenting the mother on her baby daughter's eyes, then quickly moving on to matters of greater substance, her skills as a listener, confidant, and connector fully evident. During the pastor's scripture reading, I suddenly found myself chuckling. It featured a frustrated Jesus, whose metaphorical language receives literal interpretation from his followers. Jesus answered and said to her, "Everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks the water I shall give will never thirst. The water I shall give will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life." The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I may not be thirsty or have to keep coming here to draw water." Meanwhile, the disciples urged him, "Rabbi, eat." But he said to them, "I have food to eat of which you do not know." So the disciples said to one another, "Could someone have brought him something to eat?" It was passages like these, where there is a clear mocking of literalist readings of Scripture, that had brought me back around to Christianity after a long stretch following college, when my notion of God and Jesus had grown, to put it gently, tenuous. During my sojourn in ironclad atheism, the primary arsenal leveled against Christianity had been its failure on empirical grounds. Surely enlightened reason offered a more coherent cosmos. Surely Ockham's razor cut the faithful free from blind faith. There is no proof of God, therefore it is unreasonable to believe in God. Although I had been raised in a devout Christian family where prayer and scripture readings were a nightly ritual, I, like most scientific types, came to believe in the possibility of a material conception of reality, an ultimately scientific worldview that would grant a complete metaphysics minus outmoded concepts like souls, God, and bearded white men in robes. I spent a good chunk of my 20s trying to build a frame for such an endeavor. The problem, however, eventually became evident. To make science the arbiter of metaphysics is to banish not only God from the world, but also love, hate, meaning, to consider a world that is self-evidently not the world we live in. That's not to say that if you believe in meaning, you must also believe in God. It is to say, though, that if you believe that science provides no basis for God, then you are almost obligated to conclude that science provides no basis for meaning, and, therefore, life itself doesn't have any. In other words, existential claims have no weight. All knowledge is scientific knowledge. Yet the paradox is that scientific methodology is the product of human hands and thus cannot reach some permanent truth. We build scientific theories to organize and manipulate the world to reduce phenomena into manageable units. Science is based on reproducibility and manufactured objectivity. As strong as that makes its ability to generate claims about matter and energy, it also makes scientific knowledge inapplicable to the existential, visceral nature of human life, which is unique and subjective and unpredictable. Science may provide the most useful way to organize empirical reproducible data, but its power to do so is predicated on its inability to grasp the most central aspects of human life: hope, fear, love, hate, beauty, envy, honor, weakness, striving, suffering, virtue. Between these core passions and scientific theory, there will always be a gap. No system of thought can contain the fullness of human experience. The realm of metaphysics remains the providence of revelation. This, not atheism, is what Oscam argued, after all. And atheism can be justified only on these grounds. The prototypical atheist, then, is Graham Greene's commandment from the power and the glory, whose atheism comes from a revelation of the absence of God. The only real atheism must be grounded in a world-making vision. The favorite quote of many an atheist, from the Nobel Prize-winning French biologist Jacques Menard, belies this revelatory aspect. The ancient covenant is in pieces. Man at last knows that he is alone in the unforgiving immensity of the universe, out of which he emerges only by chance. Yet, I return to the central values of Christianity, sacrifice, redemption, forgiveness, because I found them so compelling. There is a tension in the Bible between justice and mercy, between the Old Testament and the New Testament. And the New Testament says you can never be good enough. Goodness is the thing, and you can never live up to it. The main message of Jesus, I believe, is that mercy trumps justice every time. Not only that, but maybe the basic message of original sin isn't feel guilty all the time. Maybe it's more along the lines, we all have a notion of what it means to be good, and we can't live up to it all the time. Maybe that's what the message of the New Testament is, after all. Even if you have a notion as well defined as Leviticus, you can't live that way. It's just impossible. It's insane. About God, I could say nothing definitive, of course, but the basic reality of human life stands compellingly against blind determinism. Moreover, no one, myself included, credits revelation with any epistemic authority. We are all reasonable people. Revelation is not good enough. Even if God spoke to us, we'd discount it as delusional. So what, I wondered, is the aspiring metaphysician to do? Give up? Almost. Struggle toward the capital T, truth, but recognize that the task is impossible? Or that if a correct answer is possible, verification certainly is impossible? In the end, it cannot be doubted that each of us can see only a part of the picture. The doctor sees one, the patient another, the engineer a third, the economist a fourth, the pearl diver a fifth, the alcoholic a sixth, the cable guy a seventh, the sheep farmer an eighth, the Indian beggar a ninth, the pastor a tenth. Human knowledge is never contained in one person. It grows from the relationships we create between each other and the world, and still it is never complete. And truth comes somewhere above all of them, where, as at the end of that Sunday's reading, the sower and the reaper can rejoice together, for here the saying is verified that one sows and another reaps. I sent you to reap what you have not worked for. Others have done the work, and you are sharing the fruits of their work. I hopped out of the CT scanner, 7 months since I had returned to surgery. This would be my last scan before finishing residency, before becoming a father, before my future became real. "Want to take a look, doc?" the tech said. "Not right now," I said. "I've got a lot of work to do today." It was already 6 p.m. I had to go see patients, organize tomorrow's OR schedule, review films, dedicate my clinic notes, check my post-ops, and so on. Around 8 p.m., I sat down in the neurosurgery office next to a radiology viewing station. I turned it on, looked at my patient's scans for the next day, two simple spine cases, and finally typed in my own name. I zipped through the images as if they were a kid's flipbook, comparing the new scan to the last. Everything looked the same. The old tumors remained exactly the same, except, wait. I rolled back the images, looked again. There it was. A new tumor, large, filling my right middle lobe. It looked oddly like a full moon, having almost cleared the horizon. Going back to the old images, I could make out the faintest trace of it, a ghostly harbinger now brought fully into the world. I was neither angry nor scared. It simply was. It was a fact about the world, like the distance from the sun to the earth. I drove home and told Lucy. It was a Thursday night, and we wouldn't see Emma again until Monday. But Lucy and I sat down in the living room with our laptops and mapped out the next steps: biopsies, tests, chemotherapy. The treatments this time around would be tougher to endure. The possibility of a long life more remote. Elliot again. Quote, "But at my back in a cold blast I hear the rattle of the bones and chuckles spread from ear to ear." Unquote. Neurosurgery would be impossible for a couple of weeks, perhaps months, perhaps forever. But we decided that all of that could wait to be real until Monday. Today was Thursday, and I'd already made tomorrow's OR assignments. I planned on having one last day as a resident. As I stepped out of my car at the hospital at 5:30 the next morning, I inhaled deeply, smelling the eucalyptus, and was that pine? Hadn't noticed that before. I met the resident team assembled for morning rounds. We reviewed overnight events, new admissions, new scans, then went to see our patients before M&M, or Morbidity and Mortality Conference, a regular meeting in which the neurosurgeon gathered to review mistakes that had been made and cases that had gone wrong. Afterwards, I spent an extra couple of minutes with a patient, Mr. R. He had developed a rare syndrome called Gertzmann's, where after I'd removed his brain tumor, he'd begun showing several specific deficits: an inability to write, to name fingers, to do arithmetic, to tell left from right. I'd seen it only once before, as a medical student 8 years ago on one of the first patients I'd followed on the neurosurgical service. Like him, Mr. R. was euphoric. I wondered if that was part of the syndrome that no one had described before. Mr. R. was getting better, though his speech had returned almost to normal, and his arithmetic was only slightly off. He'd likely make a full recovery. The morning passed, and I scrubbed for my last case. Suddenly, the moment felt enormous. My last time scrubbing? Perhaps this was it? I watched the suds drip off my arms and down the drain. I entered the OR, gowned up and draped the patient, made sure the corners were sharp and neat. I wanted this case to be perfect. I opened the skin of his lower back. He was an elderly man whose spine had degenerated, compressing his nerve roots and causing severe pain. I pulled away the fat until the fascia appeared, and I could feel the tips of his vertebrae. I opened the fascia, and I smoothly dissected the muscle away until only the wide, glistening vertebrae showed up through the wound, clean and bloodless. The attending wandered in as I began removing the lamia, the back wall of the vertebrae, whose body overgrowth, along with ligaments beneath, were compressing the nerves. "Looks good," he said. "If you want to go to today's conference, I can have the fellow come in and finish." My back was beginning to ache. Why hadn't I taken an extra dose of NSAIDs beforehand? The case should be quick, though I was almost there. "Nah," I said, I want to finish the case." The attending scrubbed in, and together we completed the bony removal. He began to pick away at the ligaments, beneath which lay the dura, which contained spinal fluid and the nerve roots. The most common error at this stage is tearing a hole in the dura. I worked on the opposite side. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw his instrument, a flash of blue, the dura starting to peek through. "Watch out," I said, just as the mouth of his instrument bit into the dura. Clear spinal fluid began to fill the wound. I hadn't had a leak in one of my cases in more than a year. Repairing it would take another hour. "Get the micro set out," I said. "We have a leak." By the time we finished the repair and removed the compressed soft tissue, my shoulders burned. The attending broke, scrubbed, offered his apologies, and said his thanks and left me to close. The layers came together nicely. I began to suture the skin using a running nylon stitch. Most surgeons use staples, but I was convinced that nylon had lower infection rates and we would do this one, this final closure, my way. The skin came together perfectly, without tension, as if there had been no surgery at all. Good. One good thing. As we uncovered the patient, the scrub nurse, one with whom I hadn't worked before, said, "You on call this weekend, Doc?" "Nope. And possibly never again." "Got any more cases today?" "Nope. And possibly never again." "Shit, well, I guess that means this is a happy ending. Work's done. I like happy endings, don't you, Doc?" Yeah, I like happy endings." I sat down by the computer to enter orders as the nurse cleaned and the anesthesiologist began to wake the patient. I had always jokingly threatened that when I was in charge, instead of the high-energy pop music everyone likes to play in the OR, we'd listen exclusively to bossa nova. I put Getz Gilberto on the radio, and the soft, sonorous sounds of a saxophone filled the room. I left the OR shortly after, then gathered my things which had accumulated over 7 years of work. Extra sets of clothes for the night you don't leave, toothbrushes, bars of soap, phone chargers, snacks, my skull model, and collection of neurosurgery books, and so on. On second thought, I left my books behind. They'd be of more use here. On my way out to the parking lot, a fellow approached to ask something, but his pager went off. He looked at it, waved, turned, and ran back into the hospital. "I'll catch you later," he called over his shoulder. Tears welled up as I sat in the car, turned the key, and slowly pulled into the street. I drove home, walked through the front door, hung up my white coat, and took off my ID badge. I pulled the battery out of my pager. I peeled off my scrubs and took a long shower. Later that night, I called Victoria and told her I wouldn't be in on Monday, or possibly ever again, and wouldn't be setting the OR schedule. "You know, I've been having this reoccurring nightmare that this day was coming," she said. "I don't know how you did this for so long." Lucy and I met with Emma on Monday. She confirmed the plan we'd envisioned: bronchoscopic biopsy, look for targetable mutations, otherwise chemo. The real reason I was there, though, was for her guidance. I told her I was taking leave from neurosurgery. "Okay," she said. "That's fine. You can stop neurosurgery if, say, you want to focus on something that matters more to you, but not because you are sick. You aren't any sicker than you were a week ago. This is a bump in the road, but you can keep your current trajectory. Neurosurgery was important to you." Once again, I had traversed the line from doctor to patient, from actor to acted upon, from subject to direct object. My life up until my illness could be understood as a linear sum of my choices. As in most modern narratives, a character's fate depended on human actions. King Lear's Gloucester may complain about human fate as, quote, flies to wanton boys, unquote, but it's Lear's vanity that sets in motion the dramatic arc of the play. From the Enlightenment onward, the individual occupied center stage. But now, I live in a different world, a more ancient one, where human action paled against superhuman forces, a world that was more Greek tragedy than Shakespeare. No amount of effort can help Oedipus and his parents escape their fates. Their only access to the forces controlling their lives is through the oracles and seers, those given divine vision. What I had come for was not a treatment plan. I have read enough to know the medical ways forward, but the comfort of oracular wisdom. This is not the end, she said, a line she must have used 1,000 times. After all, did I not use similar speeches to my own patients, to those seeking impossible answers? Or even the beginning of the end? This is just the end of the beginning. And I felt better. A week after the biopsy, Alexis, the nurse practitioner, called. There were no new targetable mutations, so chemotherapy was the only option, and it was being set up for Monday. I asked about the specific agents and was told I'd have to talk to Emma. She was en route to Lake Tahoe with her kids, but she'd give me a call over the weekend. The next day, a Saturday, Emma called. I asked her what she thought about chemotherapy agents. Well, she said, do you have specific thoughts? I guess the main question is whether to include Avastin, I said. I know the data is mixed and that it adds potential side effects, and some cancer centers are turning away from it. In my mind, though, since there are a lot of studies supporting its use, I'd lean toward including it. We can discontinue it if I have a bad reaction to it, if that seems sensible to you. Yeah, that sounds about right. Insurance companies also make it hard to add it later, so that's another reason to use it up front. Thanks for calling. I'll let you get back to enjoying the lake. Okay, but there's one thing, she paused. I'm totally happy for us to make your medical plan together. Obviously, you're a doctor, you know what you're talking about, and it's your life. But if you ever want me to be just the doctor, I'd be happy to do that, too. I hadn't ever considered that I could release myself from the responsibility of my own medical care. I just assumed all patients became experts at their own diseases. I remember how, as a green medical student, knowing nothing, I would often end up asking patients to explain their diseases and treatments to me, their blue toes and pink pills. But as a doctor, I never expected patients to make decisions alone. I bore responsibility for the patient. And I realized I was trying to do the same thing now, my doctor self remaining responsible for my patient self. Maybe I'd been cursed by a Greek god, but abdicating control seemed irresponsible, if not impossible. Chemotherapy began on Monday. Lucy, my mother, and I went to the infusion center together. I had an IV place, settled into an easy chair, and waited. The drug cocktail would take 4.5 hours to infuse. I passed the time napping, reading, and sometimes blankly staring, with Lucy and my mother next to me, interrupting the silence with occasional small talk. The other occupants of the room were in various states of health, some bald, some well coiffed, some withered, some springing, some disheveled, some dapper, all lying still, silent, with IV tubes dripping poison into outstretched arms. I was to return every 3 weeks for treatment. I began to feel the effects the next day, a deep fatigue, a profound bone weariness setting in. Eating, normally a source of great pleasure, was like drinking seawater. Suddenly, all of my joys were salted. For breakfast, Lucy made me a bagel with cream cheese. It tasted like a salt lick. I set it aside. Reading was exhausting. I had agreed to write a few chapters on the therapeutic potential of my research with V for two major neurosurgical textbooks. That, too, I set aside. The days passed, television and forced feedings marking the time. A pattern developed over the weeks. The malaise would slowly ease, normalcy returning just in time for the next treatment. The cycles continued. I shuffled in and out of the hospital with minor complications, which were just enough to preclude any return to work. The neurosurgery department determined that I had met all national and local criteria for graduation. The ceremony was scheduled for a Saturday, about 2 weeks before Lucy's due date. The day arrived. As I stood in our bedroom, dressing for graduation, the culmination of 7 years of residency, a piercing nausea struck me. This was unlike the usual nausea of chemotherapy, which washed over you like a wave, and like a wave could be ridden. I began uncontrollably vomiting green bile, its chalky taste distinct from stomach acid. This was from deep in my gut. I would not be going to graduation after all. I needed IV fluids to avoid dehydration, so Lucy drove me to the emergency department and rehydration began. The vomiting gave way to diarrhea. The medical resident, Brad, and I chatted amicably, and I relayed my medical history, covering all my medications, and we ended up discussing advances in molecular therapies, especially Tarceva, which I was still taking. The medical plan was simple. Keep me hydrated with intravenous fluids until I could drink enough by mouth. That evening, I was admitted to a hospital room. But when the nurse reviewed my medication list, I noticed Tarceva was not on it. I asked her to call the resident to correct the oversight. These things happen. I was taking a dozen medications. After all, keeping track was not easy. It was well past midnight when Brad appeared. "I heard you had a question about your medications," he asked. "Yeah," I said. "Tarceva wasn't ordered. Do you mind ordering it?" "I decided to take you off of it." "Why is that?" "Your liver enzymes are too high to take it." I was confused. My liver enzymes had been high for months. If this was an issue, why hadn't we discussed it before? In any case, this was clearly a mistake. "Emma, my oncologist, your boss, has seen these numbers and she wants to keep me on it." Residents routinely have to make medical decisions without the attending's input, but now that he had Emma's opinion, surely he would capitulate. "But it might be causing your GI problems." My confusion deepened. Usually, invoking the attending's orders ends the discussion. "Well, I've been taking it for a year without any problems," I said. "You think Tarceva is causing this all of a sudden and not the chemotherapy?" "Maybe, yeah." Confusion yielded to anger. Some kid 2 years out of med school, no older than my junior residents, was really arguing with me? It had been one thing if he were right, but he wasn't making any sense. "Didn't I mention this afternoon that without that pill, my bone metastases become active and produce excruciating pain? I don't mean to sound dramatic, but I've broken bones boxing, and this is far more painful. As in 10 out of 10 pain. As in, I will actually soon be screaming pain." "Well, given the half-life of the drug, that probably won't happen for a day or so." I could see that in Brad's eyes, I was not a patient. I was a problem, a box to be checked off. "Look," he continued, "if you weren't you, we wouldn't even be having this conversation. I just stop the drug and make you prove it causes all this pain. What had happened to our amicable chat this afternoon? I thought back to medical school, when a patient had told me that she always wore her most expensive socks to the doctor's office so that when she was in a patient's gown and shoeless, the doctor would see the socks and know she was a person of substance, to be treated with respect. Ah, there's the problem. I was wearing hospital-issued socks, which I had been stealing for years. Anyway, Tarceva is a special drug, and it requires a fellow or attending to sign off on it. Do you really want me to wake someone up for this? Can't it wait until morning? And there it was. Meeting his obligation to me meant adding one more thing to his to-do list, an embarrassing phone call with his boss, revealing his error. He was working the night shift. Residency education regulations had forced most programs to adopt shift work, and along with shift work comes a kind of shiftlessness, a subtle undercutting of responsibility. If he could just push it off for a few more hours, I would become somebody else's problem. I usually take it at 5 a.m., I said, and you know as well as I that waiting till morning means letting someone deal with it after morning rounds, which will be more like the afternoon, right? Oh, okay, fine, he said, and he left the room. When morning arrived, I discovered that he had not ordered the medication. Emma dropped in to say hello and told me she would sort out the Tarceva order. She wished me a speedy recovery and apologized for the fact that she was heading out of town for a week. Over the course of the day, I began to deteriorate, my diarrhea rapidly worsening. I was being rehydrated, but not quickly enough. My kidneys began to fail. My mouth became so dry I could not speak or swallow. At the next lab check, my serum sodium had reached a near-fatal level. I was transferred to the ICU. Part of my soft palate and pharynx died from dehydration and peeled out of my mouth. I was in pain, floating through varying levels of consciousness, while a pantheon of specialists was brought together to help. Medical intensivists, nephrologists, gastroenterologists, endocrinologists, infectious disease specialists, neurosurgeons, general oncologists, thoracic oncologists, otolaryngologists. Lucy, 38 weeks pregnant, stayed with me by day and secretly moved into my old call room, steps from the ICU, so she could check on me at night. She and my father also lent their voices. During lucid moments, I was actually aware that with this many voices, cacophony results. In medicine, this is known as the Wickos problem. Who is the captain of the ship? The nephrologist disagreed with the ICU doctors, who disagreed with the endocrinologists, who disagreed with the oncologist, who disagreed with the gastroenterologist. I felt the responsibility of my care during bouts of consciousness. I typed out the sequential details of my current illness and, with Lucy's help, tried to corral all the doctors to keep the facts and interpretation straight. Later, while half asleep, I could dimly hear my father and Lucy discussing my condition with each team of doctors. We suspected that the main plan should be just to treat me with fluids until the effects of the chemotherapy wore off. But each group of specialists had to allow for more esoteric possibilities and advocate tests and treatment for them, some of which seemed unnecessary and ill-advised. Samples were taken, scans were ordered, medications were given. I began to lose track of events and times. I requested that these plans be explained to me, but sentences would become slippery, voices would dampen and muffle, and darkness would descend in the midst of doctors' speeches as I wobbled in and out of coherence. I desperately wished Emma were there, in charge. Suddenly, she appeared. "You're back already," I said. "You've been in ICU for over a week," she said. "But don't worry, you're getting better. Most of your labs have normalized. You'll be out of here soon." She'd been in touch with my doctors over email, I learned. "You know how you offered to just be the doctor and I could just be the patient?" I asked. "I think that's maybe a good idea. I've been reading science and literature, trying to find out the right perspective, but I haven't found it." "I'm not sure that's something you can find by reading about it," she replied. Emma was now the captain of the ship, lending a sense of calm to the chaos of this hospitalization. T.S. Eliot sprang to mind. "Drumyata." The boat responded. Gaily to the hand expert with sail and oar, the sea was calm, your heart would have responded. Gaily, when invited, beating obedient to controlling hands. I leaned back in my hospital bed and closed my eyes. As the darkness of delirium descended again, I finally relaxed. Lucy's due date came and went without labor, and I was finally scheduled to be discharged from the hospital. I had lost over 40 pounds since being diagnosed, 15 in the last week. I weighed as much as I had in eighth grade, though my hair had considerably thinned since those days, most of it in the past month. I was awake again, alert to the world, but withered. I could see my bones against my skin, a living X-ray. At home, simply holding my head up was tiring. Lifting a glass of water required both hands. Reading was out of the question. Both sets of parents were in town to help. 2 days after discharge, Lucy had her first contractions. She stayed home while my mother drove me to my follow-up appointment with Emma. "Frustrated?" Emma asked. "No, you should be. It's going to be a long recovery." "Well, yes, okay, I am frustrated on the big picture. But on the day-to-day, I'm ready to get back to physical therapy and start recovering. I did it once, so it should be old hat, right?" "Did you see your last scan?" she asked. "No, I've kind of stopped looking." "Well, it looks good," she said. "The disease looks stable, maybe even slightly shrinking." We talked through some of the coming logistics. Chemotherapy would be on hold until I was stronger. Experimental trials wouldn't accept me in my current state either. Treatment wasn't an option, not until I regained some strength. I leaned my head against the wall to support the flagging muscles of my neck. My thoughts were clouded. I needed that oracle to scry again, to gather secrets from birds or star charts, from mutant genes or Kaplan-Meier graphs. "Emma," I said, "what's the next step?" "Get stronger. That's it." "But when the cancer recurs, I mean the probabilities..." I paused. First-line therapy, Tarceva, had failed. Second-line therapy, chemo, had nearly killed me. Third-line therapy, if I could even get there, made few promises. Beyond that, the vast unknown of experimental treatments. Phrases of doubt fell from my mouth. "I mean, getting back to the OR, or even walking, or even..." "You have 5 good years left," she said. She pronounced it, but without the authoritative tone of an oracle, without the confidence of a true believer. She said it, instead, like a plea, like that patient who could speak only in numbers, like she was not so much speaking to me as pleading, a mere human with whatever forces and fates truly control these things. There we were, doctor and patient, in a relationship that sometimes carries a magisterial air and at other times, like now, was no more and no less than two people huddled together as one faces the abyss. Doctors, it turns out, need hope too. On the way home from the appointment with Emma, Lucy's mom called to say that they were headed to the hospital. Lucy was in labor. "Make sure you ask about the epidural early," I told her. She had suffered enough. I returned to the hospital, pushed by my father in a wheelchair. I lay down on a cot in the delivery room, heat packs and blankets keeping my skeletal body from shivering. For the next 2 hours, I watched Lucy and the nurse go through the ritual of labor. As a contraction built up, the nurse counted off the pushing. And a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and a 10. Lucy turned to me, smiling. "It feels like I'm playing a sport," she said. I lay on the cot and smiled back, watching her belly rise. There would be so many absences in Lucy's and my daughter's life if this was as present as I could be. Then so be it. Sometime after midnight, the nurse nudged me awake. "It's almost time," she whispered. She gathered the blankets and helped me to a chair next to Lucy. The obstetrician was already in the room, no older than I. She looked up at me as the baby was crowning. "I can tell you one thing, your daughter has hair exactly like yours," she said, "and a lot of it." I nodded, holding Lucy's hand during the last moments of her labor. And then, with one final push, on July 4th at 2:11 a.m., there she was, Elizabeth Acadia, Katie. We had picked the name months before. "Can we put her on your skin, Papa?" the nurse asked me. No, I'm too cold, I said, my teeth chattering, "but I would love to hold her." They wrapped her in blankets and handed her to me. Feeling her weight in one arm and gripping Lucy's hand with the other, the possibilities of life emanated before us. The cancer cells in my body would still be dying, or they'd start growing again. Looking out over the expanse ahead, I saw not an empty wasteland, but something simpler, a blank page on which I would go on. Yet there is a dynamism in our house. Day to day, week to week, Katie blossoms. A first grasp, a first smile, a first laugh. Her pediatrician regularly records her growth on charts, tick marks indicating her progress over time. A brightening newness surrounds her as she sits in my lap, smiling, enthralled by my tuneless singing, and incandescent lights the room. Time for me is now double-edged. Every day brings me further from the low of my last relapse, but closer to the next reoccurrence, and eventually, death. Perhaps later than I think, but certainly sooner than I desire. There are, I imagine, two responses to that realization. The most obvious might be an impulse to frantic activity, to live life to its fullest, to travel, to dine, to achieve a host of neglected ambitions. Part of the cruelty of cancer, though, is not only that it limits your time, it also limits your energy, vastly reducing the amount you can squeeze into a day. It is a tired hare who now races, and even if I had the energy, I prefer a more tortoise-like approach. I plod, I ponder, some days I simply persist. If time dilates when one moves at high speeds, does it contract when one moves barely at all? It must. The days have shortened considerably. With little to distinguish one day from the next, time has begun to feel static. In English, we use the word time in different ways. The time is 2:45 versus I'm going through a tough time. These days, time feels less like the ticking clock and more like a state of being. Languor settles in. There's a feeling of openness. As a surgeon focused on a patient in the OR, I might have found the position of the clock's hands arbitrary, but I never thought them meaningless. Now the time of day means nothing. The day of the week, scarcely more. Medical training is relentlessly future-oriented, all about delayed gratification. You're always thinking about what you'll be doing 5 years down the line. But now I don't know what I'll be doing 5 years down the line. I may be dead. I may not be. I may be healthy. I may be writing. I don't know. And so it's not all that useful to spend time thinking about the future. That is, beyond lunch. Verb conjugation has become muddled as well. Which is correct? I am a neurosurgeon, I was a neurosurgeon, or I had been a neurosurgeon before and will be again. Graham Greene once said that life was lived in the first 20 years and the remainder was just reflection. So what tense am I living in now? Have I proceeded beyond the present tense and into the past perfect? The future tense seems vacant and, on others' lips, jarring. A few months ago, I celebrated my 15th college reunion at Stanford and stood out on the quad drinking a whiskey as the pink sun dipped below the horizon. When old friends called out parting promises, "We'll see you at the 25th," it seemed rude to respond, "Well, probably not." Everyone succumbs to finitude. I suspect I am not the only one who reaches this pluperfect state. Most ambitions are either achieved or abandoned. Either way, they belong to the past. The future, instead of the ladder toward the goals of life, flattens out into a perpetual present. Money, status, all the vanities the preacher of Ecclesiastes described hold so little interest, a chasing after wind, indeed. Yet one thing cannot be robbed of her futurity, our daughter, Katie. I hope I'll live long enough that she has some memory of me. Words have a longevity I do not. I thought I could leave her a series of letters, but what would they say? I don't know what this girl will be like when she's 15. I don't even know if she'll take to the nickname we've given her. There is perhaps only one thing to say to this infant, who is all future, overlapping briefly with me, whose life, barring the improbable, is all but past. That message is simple. When you come to one of the many moments in life where you must give an account of yourself, provide a ledger of what you have been and done and meant to the world, do not, I pray, discount that you filled a dying man's day with a sated joy, a joy unknown to me in all my prior years, a joy that does not hunger for more and more, but rests satisfied. In this time, right now, that is an enormous thing.